problems similar to Roberta's assessed these issues. This written exercise motivated her to look within herself for what she had been seeking in others, and enabled her to see that her dependency was the real enemy, because it incapacitated her. Perceiving the difference between loneliness and being alone. As you read the previous section, you may have concluded that it would be to your advantage if you could learn to regulate your moods and find happiness within yourself. This would give you the capacity to feel as alive when you are alone as when you are with someone you love. But you may be thinking, that all sounds well and good, Dr. Burns, but it is not realistic. The truth is that it is undeniably emotionally inferior to be alone. All my life I have known that love and happiness are identical, and all my friends agree. You can philosophize until you're blue in the face, but when it comes down to the bottom line, love is where it's at, and being alone is a curse. In fact, many people are convinced that love makes the world go around. You see this message in ads. You hear it in popular songs. You read it in poems. You can, however, convincingly disprove your assumption that love is necessary before you can experience happiness. Let's take a hard look at the equation. Alone equals lonely. Consider first that we get many of life's basic satisfactions by ourselves. For example, when you climb a mountain, pick a flower, read a book, or eat a hot fudge sundae, you do not require someone else's company for these experiences to be enjoyable. A physician can enjoy the satisfaction of treating a patient, whether or not he and the patient are involved in a meaningful personal relationship. When writing a book, an author is generally by himself or herself. As most students know, you do most of your learning when you are alone. The list of pleasures and satisfactions that you can enjoy when alone is endless. This indicates that many sources of gratification are accessible to you, whether or not you are with someone else. Can you add to that list? What are some pleasures that you can have alone? Do you ever listen to good music on your stereo? Do you enjoy gardening, jogging, carpentry, hiking? A lonely bank teller named Janet, who was recently separated from her husband, enrolled in a creative dancing class and found, to her surprise, that she could derive enormous pleasure from practicing by herself at home. As she became caught up in the rhythm of the movements, she felt at peace with herself, in spite of the fact that she had no one to love. Perhaps you're thinking now, oh, Dr. Burns, is that your point? Well, it's trivial. Of course I can experience temporary moments of mediocre distraction by doing things when I'm alone. This might take the edge off the blues, but those things are just some crumbs from the table that might keep me from starving totally. I want the banquet, the real thing, love, true and complete happiness. That was exactly what Janet told me before she enrolled in the dancing class. Because she assumed it was miserable to be alone, it hadn't occurred to her to do enjoyable things and care for herself during the separation from her husband. She had been living according to a double standard whereby, if she was with her husband, she would go to great lengths to plan pleasurable activities. But when she was alone, she would simply mope and do very little. This pattern obviously functioned as a self-fulfilling prophecy, and she did in fact find it unpleasant to be alone. Why? Simply because she failed to treat herself in a caring way. It had never occurred to her to challenge her lifelong assumption that all her activities would be unsatisfactory unless she had someone to share them with. On another occasion, instead of heating a TV dinner after work, Janet decided to plan a special meal, just as if she were going to entertain a man she cared a lot about. She carefully prepared her dinner and set the table with candles. She began with a glass of fine wine. After dinner, she read a good book and listened to her favorite music. To her amazement, she found the evening a total pleasure. The next day, which was Saturday, Janet decided to go to the art museum alone. She was surprised to discover that she got more enjoyment out of this excursion alone than she had in the past when dragging her reluctant and disinterested husband along. As a result of adopting an active, compassionate attitude toward herself, Janet discovered for the first time in her life that she could not only make it on her own, but could really enjoy herself. As is so often the case, she began to generate an infectious joy of living that caused many individuals to feel attracted to her, and she began to date. In the meantime, her husband began to get disillusioned with his girlfriend and wanted his wife back. He noticed Janet was happy as a lark without him, and at this point the tables began to turn. After Janet told him she no longer wanted him back, he suffered a severe depression. She ultimately established a very satisfying relationship with another man and remarried. The key to her success was simple. As a first step, she proved that she could develop a relationship with herself. After this, the rest was easy. The pleasure predicting method. I don't expect you to rely on my word on this topic, or even on the reports of others like Janet who have learned how to experience the joys of self-reliance. Instead, I propose you perform a series of experiments, just as Janet did, to test out your belief that being alone is a curse. If you're willing to do this, you can arrive at the truth in an objective, scientific manner. To help you, I have developed the pleasure predicting sheet shown in Figure 12.2 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. This form is divided into a series of columns in which you predict and record the actual amount of satisfaction you derive from various work and recreational activities you engage in when alone, as well as from those you share with other people. In the first column, record the date of each experiment. In the second column, write down several activities that you plan to do as a part of that day's experiments. I suggest that you carry out a series of 40 or 50 experiments over a 2 to 3 week period. Choose activities that would ordinarily give you a sense of accomplishment or pleasure, or which have the potential for learning or personal growth. In the third column, record who you do the activity with. If you do it alone, write self in this column. This word will remind you that you are never really alone, since you are always with yourself. In the fourth column, predict the satisfaction you think you will derive from this activity, estimating it on a scale of between 0 and 100%. The higher the number, the greater the anticipated satisfaction. Fill in the fourth column before you do each planned activity, not after. Once you have filled in the columns, proceed with the activities. Once they are completed, record the actual satisfaction in the last column using the same 0 to 100% rating system. After you have performed a series of such experiments, you will be able to interpret the data you have collected. You can learn many things, first by comparing the predicted satisfaction, column 4, with the actual satisfaction, column 5. You will be able to find out how accurate your predictions are. You may find that you typically underestimate the amount of satisfaction you anticipate experiencing, especially when doing things alone. You might also be surprised to learn that activities with others are not always as satisfying as anticipated. In fact, you may even find that there are many times when it was more enjoyable to be alone, and you might discover that the highest ratings you received when you were alone were equal to or higher than those for activities involving others. It can be helpful to compare the amount of satisfaction you derived from work activities versus pleasurable activities. This information can help you achieve an optimal balance between work and fun as you continue to plan your activities. Questions are probably now crossing your mind. Suppose I do something and it isn't as satisfying as I predicted. Or suppose I make a low prediction and it really comes out that way. In this case, try to pinpoint the automatic negative thoughts that dampen the experience for you. Then, talk back to these thoughts. For example, a lonely 65-year-old woman whose children were all grown and married decided to enroll in an evening course. All the other students were of college freshman age. She felt tense the first week of classes because of her thought, "They probably think I'm an old bag with no right to be here." When she reminded herself she had no idea what the other students thought of her, she felt some relief. After talking to another student, she found out that some of them admired her gumption. She then felt much better, and her satisfaction levels began to climb. Now let's see how the pleasure-predicting sheet can be used to overcome dependency. Joni was a 15-year-old high school student who had suffered from a chronic depression for several years after her parents moved to a new town. She had difficulty making friends in the new high school and believed, as many teenage girls do, that she had to have a boyfriend and be a member of the in crowd before she could be happy. She spent nearly all her free time at home alone, studying and feeling sorry for herself. She resisted and resented the suggestion she start going out and doing things because she claimed there would simply be no point in doing them alone. Until a circle of friends magically dropped into her lap, she seemed determined to sit and brood. I persuaded Joni to use the pleasure predicting sheet. Figure 12.2 in the enhancement shows that Joni scheduled a variety of activities, such as visiting an arts and crafts center on a Saturday, going to a rock concert, etc. Because she did them alone, she anticipated they would be unrewarding, as indicated by her low predictions in column 4. She was surprised to find she actually did have a reasonably good time. As this pattern tended to repeat itself, she began to realize that she was predicting things in an unrealistic, negative way. As she did more and more on her own, her mood began to improve. She still wanted friends, but no longer felt condemned to misery when she was alone. Because she proved she could make it on her own, her self-confidence went up. She then became more assertive with her peers and invited several people to a party. This helped her develop a network of friends, and she found that boys as well as girls in her high school class were interested in her. Joni continued to use the pleasure predicting sheet to evaluate the levels of satisfaction she experienced in dates and activities with her new friends. She was surprised to find that they were comparable to the enjoyment levels she experienced in doing things alone. There is a difference between wanting and needing something. Oxygen is a need, but love is a want. I repeat, love is not an adult human need. It's okay to want a loving relationship with another human being. There is nothing wrong with that. It is a delicious pleasure to be involved in a good relationship with someone you love. But you do not need that external approval, love, or attention in order to survive or to experience maximal levels of happiness. Attitude modification. Just as love, companionship, and marriage are not necessary for happiness and self-esteem, they are not sufficient either. The proof of this is the millions of men and women who are married and miserable. If love were the antidote to depression, then I would soon be out of business because the vast majority of the suicidal individuals I treat are in fact loved very dearly by their spouses, children, parents, and friends. Love is not an effective antidepressant. Like tranquilizers, alcohol, and sleeping pills, it often makes the symptoms worse. In addition to restructuring your activities more creatively, challenge the upsetting negative thoughts that flow through your mind when you are alone. This was helpful to Maria, a lovely 30-year-old single woman who found that when she did activities on her own, she sometimes soured the experience unnecessarily by telling herself, "Being alone is a curse." In order to combat the feelings of self-pity and resentment this thought created, she wrote a list of counter-arguments, which can be found in Figure 12.3 on the enhancement. She reported this was very helpful in breaking the cycle of loneliness and depression. Over a year after terminating my work with her, I sent her an early draft of this chapter, and she wrote back, "Last night, I read very thoroughly the chapter. It proves it is not being alone that is so bad or so good, but rather how one thinks regarding that or any other condition of being. Thoughts are so powerful. They can make or break you, right? It is almost funny, but now I am almost afraid to have a man. I do rather well, maybe better, without one. Dave, did you ever think you would hear this from me?" The double column technique can be especially useful in helping you overcome the negative thinking pattern that makes you fear standing on your own two feet. For example, a divorced woman with one child contemplated suicide because her lover, a married man, had broken off with her. She had an intensely negative self-image and didn't believe that she would ever be capable of sustaining an ongoing relationship. She was sure she would always end up a reject and a loner. She wrote in her journal the following thoughts as she contemplated a suicide attempt. "The empty place in the bed next to me silently mocks me. I am alone. Alone, my greatest fear, my most dreaded fate, a reality. I am a woman alone. And in my mind, that means I am nothing. The logic I am operating on goes something like this. 1. If I were desirable and attractive, there would be a man beside me now. 2. There is no man beside me. 3. Therefore, I am undesirable and unattractive. 4. Therefore, there is no point in living." She went on to ask herself in her journal, "Why do I need a man? A man would solve all my problems. He would take care of me. He would give my life direction, and most importantly, he would provide me with a reason to get out of bed each morning, when all I now want to do is put my head under the covers and sink into oblivion. She then utilized the double column technique as a way of challenging the upsetting thoughts in her mind. She labeled the left-hand column accusations of my dependent self, and labeled the right-hand column counterarguments of my independent self. She then carried out a dialogue with herself to determine what the truth of the matter really was, which you can see for yourself in Figure 12.4 on the enhancement. After doing the written exercise, she decided to read it over each morning in order to develop the motivation to get out of bed. She wrote the following outcome in her personal diary. I learned to see that there is a big difference between wanting and needing. I want a man, but I no longer feel that I must have a man to survive. By maintaining a more realistic inner dialogue with myself and by looking at my own strengths, by listing and reading again the things that I have obtained on my own, I slowly am beginning to develop a sense of confidence in my ability to handle what might come. I find that I am taking better care of myself. I am treating myself as I would have treated a beloved friend in the past, with kindness and compassion, with a tolerance for flaws and an appreciation of assets. Now, I can view a difficult situation not as a pestilence especially contrived to plague me, but as an opportunity to practice the skills I am learning, to challenge my negative thoughts, to reaffirm my strengths, and to enhance my confidence in my ability to deal with life. Chapter 13. Your work is not your worth. A third silent assumption that leads to anxiety and depression is, my worth as a human being is proportional to what I have achieved in my life. This attitude is at the core of Western culture and the Protestant work ethic. It sounds innocent enough. In fact, it is self-defeating, grossly inaccurate, and malignant. Ned, the physician described in earlier chapters, called me at home one recent Sunday evening. He had been feeling panicky all weekend. His upset was triggered by plans to attend the 20th reunion of his college class. He graduated from an Ivy League college. He had been invited to give the keynote address to the alumni. Why was Ned in such a state of apprehension? He was concerned that he might meet up with some classmate at his reunion who had achieved more than he had. He explained why this was so threatening. It would mean I was a failure. Ned's exaggerated preoccupation with his achievements is particularly common among men. While women are not immune to career concerns, they are more likely to be depressed after the loss of love or approval. Men, in contrast, are especially vulnerable to concerns about career failure because they've been programmed from childhood to base their worth on their accomplishments. The first step in changing any personal value is to determine if it works more to your advantage or disadvantage. Deciding that it will not really help you to measure your worth by what you produce is the crucial first step in changing your philosophy. Let's begin with a pragmatic approach, a cost-benefit analysis. Clearly, there can be some advantage to equating your self-esteem with your accomplishments. In the first place, you can say, I'm okay, and feel good about yourself when you have achieved something. For example, if you win a golf game, you can pat yourself on the back and feel a little smug and superior to your partner because he missed his putt on the last hole. When you go jogging with a friend and he runs out of breath before you do, you can puff up with pride and tell yourself, he's a good guy for sure, but I'm just a little better. When you make a big sale at work, you can say, I'm producing today, I'm doing a good job, my boss will be pleased and I can respect myself. Essentially, your work ethic allows you to feel you've earned personal worth and the right to feel happy. This belief system may make you especially motivated to produce. You might put extra effort into your career because you're convinced this will give you extra worthiness units, and you will therefore see yourself as a more desirable person. You can avoid the horrors of being just average. In a nutshell, you may work harder to win, and when you win, you may like yourself better. Let's look at the other side of the coin. What are the disadvantages of your philosophy of worth equals achievement? First, if your business or career is going well, you may become so preoccupied with it that you may inadvertently cut yourself off from the other potential sources of satisfaction and enjoyment as you slave away from early morning to late night. As you become more and more of a workaholic, you will feel excessively driven to produce because if you fail to keep up the pace, you will experience a severe withdrawal, characterized by inner emptiness and despair. In the absence of achievement, you'll feel worthless and bored because you'll have no other basis for self-respect and fulfillment. Suppose as a result of illness, business reversal, retirement, or some other factor beyond your control, you find you are unable to produce at the same high level for a period of time. Now you may pay the price of a severe depression triggered by the conviction that because you are less productive, it means you are no good. You'll feel like a tin can that's been used and is now ready for the trash. Your lack of self-esteem might even culminate in a suicide attempt, the ultimate payment for measuring your worth exclusively by the standards of the marketplace. Do you want this? Do you need this? There may be other prices to pay. If your family suffers from your neglect, a certain resentment may build up. For a long time, they may hold it in, but sooner or later, you'll get the bill. Your wife has been having an affair and is talking about divorce. Your 14-year-old son has been arrested for burglary. When you try to talk with him, he snubs you. Where have you been all these years, Dad? Even if these unfortunate developments do not happen to you, you will still have one great disadvantage, the lack of true self-esteem. I have recently begun treating a very successful businessman. He claims to be one of the top money earners in the world in his profession. Yet he is victimized by episodic states of fear and anxiety. What if he should fall off the pinnacle? What if he had to give up his Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud and drive a Chevrolet instead? That would be unbearable. Could he survive? Could he still love himself? He doesn't know if he could find happiness without the glamour or glory. His nerves are constantly on edge because he can't answer these questions. What would your answer be? Would you still respect and love yourself if you experienced a substantial failure? As with any addiction, you find that greater and greater doses of your upper will be needed in order to become high. This tolerance phenomenon occurs with heroin, speed, amphetamines, alcohol, and sleeping pills. It also happens with riches, fame, and success. Why? Perhaps because you automatically set your expectations higher and higher once you have achieved a particular level. The excitement quickly wears off. Why doesn't the aura last? Why do you keep needing more and more? The answer is obvious. Success does not guarantee happiness. The two are not identical and are not causally related. So you end up chasing a mirage. Since your thoughts are the true key to your moods and not success, the thrill of victory fades quickly. The old achievements soon become old hat. You begin to feel sadly bored and empty as you stare at your trophy case. If you do not get the message that happiness does not reliably and necessarily follow from success, you may work even harder to try to recapture the feeling you once had from being on top. This is the basis for your addiction to work. Many individuals seek guidance or therapy because of the disillusionment that begins to dawn on them in their middle or later years. Eventually, these questions may confront you as well. What's my life all about? What's the meaning of it all? You may believe your success makes you worthwhile, but the promised payoff seems elusive, just beyond your grasp. As you read the above paragraphs, you may suspect that the disadvantages of being a success junkie outweigh the advantages. But you may still believe it is basically true that people who are super achievers are more worthwhile. The big shots seem special in some way. You may be convinced that true happiness, as well as the respect of others, comes primarily from achievement. But is this really the case? In the first place, consider the fact that most human beings are not great achievers. Yet most people are happy and well-respected. In fact, one could say that the majority of the people in the United States are loved and happy, yet by definition most of them are pretty much average. Thus, it cannot be the case that happiness and love come only through great achievement. Depression, like the plague, is no respecter of status and strikes those who live in fancy neighborhoods as often, if not more frequently, as it does those of average or below average means. Clearly, happiness and great achievement have no necessary connection. Does work equal worth? Okay, let's assume you've decided that it's not to your advantage to link your work and your worth. And you also admit that achievement will not reliably bring you love, respect, or happiness. You may still feel convinced that on some level people who achieve a lot are somehow better than others. Let's take a hard look at this notion. First, would you say that everybody who achieves is particularly worthwhile just because of their achievement? Adolf Hitler was clearly a great achiever at the height of his career. Would you say that made him particularly worthwhile? Obviously not. Of course, Hitler would have insisted he was a great human being because he was a successful leader and because he equated his worth and achievements. In fact, he was probably convinced that he and his fellow Nazis were supermen because they were achieving so much. Would you agree with them? Perhaps you can think of a neighbor or someone you don't like very much who does achieve a lot and yet seems overly grasping and aggressive. Now, is that person especially worthwhile in your opinion just because he or she is an achiever? In contrast, perhaps you know someone you care for or respect who is not a particularly great achiever. Would you say that person is still worthwhile? If you answer yes, then ask yourself, if they can be worthwhile without great achievement, then why can't I be? Here's a second method. If you insist your worth is determined by your achievement, you are creating a self-esteem equation. Worth equals achievement. What is the basis for making this equation? What objective proof do you have that it is valid? Could you experimentally measure people's worth as well as their achievement so as to find out if they were in fact equal? What units would you use to measure it? The whole idea is nonsense. You can't prove the equation because it is just a stipulation, a value system. You're defining worth as achievement and achievement as worth. Why define them as each other? Why not say worth is worth and achievement is achievement? Worth and achievement are different words with different meanings. In spite of the above arguments, you may still be convinced that people who achieve more are better in some way. If so, I'm going to hit you now with a most powerful method which, like dynamite, can shatter this attitude even when it appears to be etched in granite. First, I would like you to play the role of Sonia, or Bob, an old friend from high school days. You have a family and teach school. I have pursued a more ambitious career. In the dialogue, you will assume that human worth is determined by achievement, and I will push the implications of this to their obvious, logical, and obnoxious conclusion. Are you ready? I hope so, because you're about to be assaulted in a most unpleasant way by a belief you apparently still cherish. David. Sonia, or Bob, how are you doing? You, playing the role of my old friend. Just fine, David, how are you? Oh, great, I haven't seen you since high school. What's been happening? Oh, well, I got married, and I'm teaching at Parks High School, and I have a little family at home. Things are great. Well, gee, I'm sorry to hear that. I turned out a lot better than you. How's that? Come again? I went to graduate school, and I got my Ph.D., and I have become quite successful in business. I'm earning a lot of money. In fact, I'm one of the wealthier people in town now. I've achieved a great deal. More than you, by a long shot. I don't mean to insult you or anything, but I guess that means I'm a lot better person than you, hmm? Well, gee, Dave, I'm not sure what to say. I thought I was a rather happy person before I started to talk to you. I can understand that. You're at a loss for words. But you might as well face facts. I've got what it takes, and you don't. I'm glad you're happy, though. Mediocre, average people are entitled to a little happiness, too. After all, I certainly don't begrudge you a few crumbs from the banquet table. But it's just too bad you couldn't have done more with your life. Dave, you seem to have changed. You were such a nice person in high school. I get the feeling you don't like me anymore. Oh, no, we can still be friends as long as you admit you're an inferior second-rate person. I just want to remind you to look up to me from now on. And I want you to realize that I'll look down on you because I'm more worthwhile. This follows from the assumption that we have worth equals achievement. Remember that attitude you cherish? I've achieved more, so I'm worth more. Well, I sure hope I don't run into you soon again, Dave. It's not been such a pleasure talking to you. That dialogue cools most people off very quickly because it illustrates how the inferior-superior system follows logically from equating your worth with your achievement. Actually, many people do feel inferior. The role-playing can help you see how ludicrous the assumption is. In the above dialogue, who is acting jerky? The happy housewife school teacher or the arrogant businessman trying to make a case that he was better than other people? I hope this imaginary conversation will help you see clearly how screwball the whole system is. If you like, we can do a role reversal to put the icing on the cake. This time, you play the role of the very successful person, and I want you to try to put me down as sadistically as you can. You can pretend to be the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine, Helen Gurley Brown. I went to high school with you. I'm just an average high school teacher now, and it's your job to argue that you're better than I am. You, playing the role of Helen Gurley Brown. Dave, how have you been? It's been a long time. David, playing the role of a high school teacher. Well, fine. I have a little family, and I'm teaching high school here. I'm a physical education teacher and really enjoying life. I understand you've made it big. Yeah, well, I really have been kind of lucky. I'm editor of Cosmopolitan now. Perhaps you heard? Of course I have. I've seen you on TV, on the talk shows, plenty of times. I hear you make a huge income, and you even have your own agent. Life's been good, yeah. It's really been terrific. Now, there's just one thing I heard about you that I really don't understand. You were talking to a friend of ours, and you were saying how you're so much better than I am now that you've made it big, whereas my career is just average. What did you mean by that? Well, Dave, I mean, just think about all the things I've accomplished in my life. Here I am, influencing millions, and who ever heard of Dave Burns in Philadelphia? I'm hobnobbing with the stars, and you're bouncing a basketball around in the court with a bunch of kids. Don't get me wrong. You're certainly a fine, sincere, average person. It's just that you never made it, so you might as well face facts. You've made a great impact, and you're a woman of influence and fame. I respect that a lot, and it sounds quite rewarding and exciting. But please forgive me if I'm dense. I just don't understand how that makes you a better person. How does that make me inferior to you or make you more worthwhile? With my little local mind, I must be missing something obvious. Face it, you just sit around and interact with no particular purpose or destiny. I have charisma. I'm a mover and shaker. That gives me a bit of an edge, wouldn't you say? Well, I don't interact to no purpose, but my purposes may seem modest in comparison with yours. I teach phys ed, and I coach the local football games, and that kind of thing. Your orbit is certainly big and fancy in comparison with mine. But I don't understand how that makes you a better person than I am, or how it follows that I'm inferior to you. I'm just more highly developed and more elaborate. I think about more important things. I go on the lecture circuit, and people flock to hear me by the thousands. Famous authors work for me. Who do you lecture to? The local PTA? Certainly in achievement, money, and influence, you're way ahead of me. You've done very well. You were very bright to begin with, and you've worked very hard. You're a big success now. But how does that make you more worthwhile than I am? You must forgive me, but I still don't grasp your logic. I'm more interesting. It's like an amoeba versus a highly developed biological structure. Amoebas are kind of boring after a while. I mean, your life must be like an amoeba's. You're just bumming around aimlessly. I'm a more interesting, dynamic, desirable person. You're second rate. You're the burnt toast. I'm the caviar. Your life is a bore. I don't see how I can say it more clearly. My life isn't as boring as you might think. Take a close look at it. I'd be surprised to hear what you have to say here because I can't find anything boring about my life. What I do is exciting and vital to me. The people I teach are every bit as important to me as the glamorous movie stars you interact with. But even if it were true that my life were more tedious and routine and less interesting than yours, how would that make you a better person or more worthwhile? Well, I suppose it just really boils down to the fact that if you have an amoeba existence, then you can only judge it on the basis of your amoeba mentality. I can judge your situation, but you can't judge mine. What is the basis for your judgment? You can call me an amoeba, but I don't know what that means. You seem to be reduced to name-calling. All it means is that apparently my life is not especially interesting to you. Certainly I'm not nearly as successful or glamorous, but how does that make you a better or more worthwhile person? I'm almost starting to give up. Don't give up here. Press on. Perhaps you are a better person. Well, certainly society values me more. That's what makes me better. it makes you more highly valued by society. That's undoubtedly the case. I mean, Johnny Carson hasn't contacted me for any appearances recently. I've noticed that. But how does being more highly valued by society make you a more worthwhile person? I'm earning a huge salary. I'm worth millions. Just how much are you worth, Mr. Schoolteacher? You clearly have more financial worth, but how does that make you a more worthwhile human being? How does commercial success make you a better person? Dave, if you're not going to worship me, I'm not going to talk to you. Well, I don't see how that would make me less worthwhile either, unless you have the idea that you're going to go around deciding who's worthwhile based on who worships you. Of course I do. Does that go along with being editor of Cosmopolitan? If so, please tell me how you make these decisions. If I'm not worthwhile, I'd definitely like to know why, so that I can give up feeling good and considering myself equal to other people. Well, it must be that your orbit is rather small and dreary. While I'm on my Learjet to Paris, you're in a crowded school bus going to Sheboygan. My orbit may be small, but it's very gratifying. I enjoy the teaching. I enjoy the kids. I like to see them develop. I like to see them learn. At times they make mistakes, and I have to let them know. There's a lot of real love and humanity that goes on there, a lot of drama. What about that seems dreary to you? Well, there's not as much to learn, no real challenge. It seems to me that in a world as small as yours, you learn just about everything there is to learn. And then you just repeat things over and over. Your work presents quite a challenge, as it turns out. How could I know everything there is to know about even one student? They all seem complex and exciting to me. I don't think I have anybody figured out completely, do you? Working with even one student is a complex challenge to all my abilities. Having so many young people to work with is a challenge beyond what I could ask for. I don't understand what you mean when you say my world is small and boring and everything is figured out. Well, it just seems to me that you are unlikely to run into many people in your world who are going to develop as highly as I have. I don't know. Some of my students have high IQs and may develop the same way you did, and some of them are mentally subnormal and will only develop to a modest level. Most are average, and each one is fascinating to me. What did you mean when you said they were boring? Why is it that only the great achievers are interesting to you? I give in, Uncle. I hope you did, in fact, give in when you played the role of the successful snob. The method I used to thwart your claim you were better than I was quite simple. Whenever you claimed you were a better or more worthy person because of some specific quality such as intelligence, influence, status, or whatever, I immediately agreed with you that you are better in that particular quality, or set of qualities. And then I asked you, but how does that make you a better or more worthwhile person? This question cannot be answered. It will take the wind out of the sails of any system of values that sets some people up as being superior to others. The technical name for this method is operationalization. In it, you must spell out just what quality makes anyone more or less worthwhile than anyone else. You can't do it. Of course, other people would rarely think or say such insulting things to you as were said in the dialogues. The real put-down goes on in your head. You are the one who's telling yourself your lack of status or achievement or popularity or love, etc., makes you less worthwhile and desirable. So you're the one who's going to have to put an end to the persecution. You can do this in the following way. Carry on a similar dialogue with yourself. Your imaginary opponent, who we'll name the persecutor, will try to argue that you are inherently inferior or less worthwhile because of some imperfection or lack. You simply assertively agree with the grain of truth in his criticism, but raise the question of how it follows that you are less worthwhile. Here are several examples. 1. Persecutor. You're not a very good lover. Sometimes you don't even get a firm erection. This means you're less of a man and an inferior person. You. It certainly shows that I'm nervous about sex and not a particularly skilled or confident lover. But how does this make me less of a man or less of a person? Since only a man can feel nervous about an erection, this would seem to be an especially manly experience. Doing it well makes you more of a man. Furthermore, there's a great deal more to being a man than just having sex. 2. Persecutor. You're not as hardworking or as successful as most of your friends. You're lazy and no good. You. This means I'm less ambitious and hardworking. I may even be less talented, but how does it follow that I'm lazy and no good? 3. Persecutor. You're not worth much because you're not outstanding in anything. You. I agree that I don't hold a single world championship. I'm not even second best at anything. In fact, at most things, I'm pretty much average. How does it follow that I'm not worth much? 4. Persecutor. You're not popular, and you don't even have many close friends, and no one cares about you much. You have no family, and not even any casual lovers, so you're a loser. You're an inadequate person. There's obviously something wrong with you. You're worthless. You. It's true, I have no lover at this time, and there are just a few friends I feel close to. How many do I need to be an adequate person? 4? 11? If I'm not popular, it may be that I'm relatively unskilled socially, and I may have to work harder at this. But how does it follow that I'm a loser? Why am I worthless? I suggest you try out the method illustrated above. Write down the worst persecutory insults you can level at yourself and then answer them. It may be hard at first, but eventually the truth will dawn on you. You can be imperfect or unsuccessful or unloved by others, but not one iota less worthwhile. 4 paths to self-esteem. You might ask, how can I attain self-esteem if my worth doesn't come from my success or from love or approval? If you peel all these criteria away one by one and expose them as invalid bases for personal worth, it seems there will be nothing left. Just what is it that I have to do? Here are 4 valid paths to self-esteem. Choose the one that seems most useful to you. The first path is both pragmatic and philosophical. Essentially, you must acknowledge that human worth is just an abstraction. It doesn't exist. Hence, there is actually no such thing as human worth. Therefore, you cannot have it or fail to have it, and it cannot be measured. Worth is not a thing. It is just a global concept. It is so generalized it has no concrete practical meaning. Nor is it a useful and enhancing concept. It is simply self-defeating. It doesn't do you any good. It only causes suffering and misery. So rid yourself immediately of any claim to being worthy, and you'll never have to measure up again, or fear being worthless. Realize that worthy and worthless are just empty concepts when applied to a human being. Like the concept of your true self, your personal worth is just meaningless hot air. Dump your worth in the garbage can. You can put your true self in there too, if you like. You'll find you've got nothing to lose. Then you can focus on living in the here and now instead. What problems do you face in life? How will you deal with them? That's where the action is, not in the elusive mirage of worth. You may be afraid to give up yourself or your worth. What are you afraid of? What terrible thing will happen? Nothing. The following imaginary dialogue may make this clearer. Let's assume that I am worthless. I want you to rub it in and try to make me feel upset. You. Burns, you're worthless. David. Of course I'm worthless. I fully agree. I realize that there is nothing about me that makes me worthy. Love, approval, and achievement can't give me any worth, so I'll accept the fact that I have none. Should this be a problem for me? Is something bad going to happen now? Well, you must be miserable. You're just no good. Assuming I am no good, so what? What specifically do I have to be miserable about? Does being worthless put me at a disadvantage in some way? Well, how can you respect yourself? How could anyone? You're just a scum. You may think I'm a scum, but I do respect myself, and so do lots of other people. I see no valid reason not to respect myself. You may not respect me, but I don't see that as a problem. But worthless people can't be happy or have any fun. You're supposed to be depressed and despicable. My panel of experts met and determined that you're a total zero. So call the papers and let them know. I can see the headline, Philadelphia physician found to be worthless. If I'm really that bad off, it's reassuring because now I have nothing to lose. I can live my life fearlessly. Furthermore, I am happy, and I am having fun. So being a total zero can't be bad. My motto is, worthless is wonderful. In fact, I'm thinking of having a t-shirt made up like that. Perhaps I'm missing out on something, though. Apparently you're worthwhile, whereas I'm not. What good does this worth do you? Does it make you better than people like me, or what? The question may occur to you, if I gave up my belief that success adds to my personal worth, then what would be the point in doing anything? If you stay in bed all day, the probability that you will bump into something or someone that will make your day a little brighter is very small. Furthermore, there can be enormous satisfactions from daily living that are totally independent of any concept of personal worth. For example, as I am writing this, I feel very turned on, but it isn't due to my belief that I am particularly worthwhile because I'm writing it. The exhilaration comes from the creative process, pulling ideas together, editing, watching clumsy sentences sharpen up, and wondering how you will react when you read this. This process is an exciting adventure. Involvement, commitment, and taking a risk can be quite stimulating. This is an adequate payoff, to my way of thinking. You might also wonder, what is the purpose and meaning of life without a concept of worth? It's simple. Rather than grasp for worth, aim for satisfaction, pleasure, learning, mastery, personal growth, and communication with others every day of your life. Set realistic goals for yourself and work toward them. I think you will find this so abundantly gratifying, you'll forget all about worth, which in the last analysis has no more buying power than fool's gold. But I'm a humanistic or spiritual person, you might argue. I've always been taught that all human beings have worth, and I just don't want to give up this concept. Very well, if you want to look at it that way, I'll agree with you. And this brings us to the second path to self-esteem. Acknowledge that everyone has one unit of worth from the time they are born until the time they die. As an infant, you may achieve very little, and yet you are still precious and worthwhile. And when you are old or ill, relaxed or asleep, or just doing nothing, you still have worth. Your unit of worth can't be measured and can never change, and it is the same for everyone. During your lifetime, you can enhance your happiness and satisfaction through productive living, or you can act in a destructive manner and make yourself miserable. But your unit of worth is always there, along with your potential for self-esteem and joy. Since you can't measure it or change it, there is no point in dealing with it or being concerned about it. Leave that up to God. Paradoxically, this solution comes down to the same bottom line as the previous solution. It becomes pointless and irresponsible to deal with your worth, so you might as well focus on living life productively instead. What problems do you confront today? How will you go about solving them? Questions such as these are meaningful and useful, whereas rumination about your personal worth just causes you to spin your wheels. Here is the third path to self-esteem. Recognize that there is only one way you can lose a sense of self-worth, by persecuting yourself with unreasonable, illogical, negative thoughts. Self-esteem can be defined as the state that exists when you are not arbitrarily haranguing and abusing yourself, but choose to fight back against those automatic thoughts with meaningful, rational responses. When you do this effectively, you will experience a natural sense of jubilation and self-endorsement. Essentially, you don't have to get the river flowing, you just have to avoid damming it. Since only distortion can rob you of self-esteem, this means that nothing in reality can take away your sense of worth. As evidence for this, many individuals under conditions of extreme and realistic deprivation do not experience a loss of self-esteem. Indeed, some individuals who were imprisoned by the Nazis during World War II refused to belittle themselves or buy into the persecutions of their captors. They reported an actual enhancement of self-esteem in spite of the miseries they were subjected to, and in some cases described experiences of spiritual awakening. Here is the fourth solution. Self-esteem can be viewed as your decision to treat yourself like a beloved friend. Imagine that some VIP you respect came unexpectedly to visit you one day. How might you treat that person? You would wear your best clothes and offer your finest wine and food, and you would do everything you could to make him feel comfortable and pleased with his visit. You would be sure to let him know how highly you valued him and how honored you were that he chose to spend some time with you. Now, why not treat yourself like that? Do it all the time if you can. After all, in the final analysis, no matter how impressed you are with your favorite VIP, you are more important to you than he is. So why not treat yourself at least as well? Would you insult and harangue such a guest with vicious, distorted put-downs? Would you peck away at his weaknesses and imperfections? Then why do this to yourself? Your self-torment becomes pretty silly when you look at it this way. Do you have to earn the right to treat yourself in this loving, caring way? No, this attitude of self-esteem will be an assertion that you make, based on a full awareness and acceptance of your strengths and imperfections. You will fully acknowledge your positive attributes without false humility or a sense of superiority, and will freely admit to all your errors and inadequacies without any sense of inferiority or self-depreciation whatever. This attitude embodies the essence of self-love and self-respect. It does not have to be earned, and it cannot be earned in any way. Escape from the achievement trap. You might be thinking, all that philosophizing about achievement and self-worth is well and good. After all, Dr. Burns has a good career and a book on the market, so it's easy for him to tell me to forget about achievement. It sounds about as genuine as a rich man trying to explain to a beggar that money isn't important. The raw fact is, I still feel bad about myself when I do poorly, and I believe that life would be a whole lot more exciting and meaningful if I had more success. The truly happy people are the big shots, the executives. I'm only average. I've never done anything really outstanding, so I'm bound to be less happy and satisfied. If this isn't right, then prove it to me. Show me what I can do to change the way I feel, and only then will I be a true believer. Let's review several steps you might take to liberate yourself from the trap of feeling you must perform in an outstanding manner in order to earn your right to feel worthwhile and happy. Remember to talk back. The first useful method is to keep practicing the habit of talking back to those negative, distorted thoughts which cause you to feel inadequate. This will help you realize that the problem is not your actual performance, but the critical way in which you put yourself down. As you learn to evaluate what you do realistically, you will experience increased satisfaction and self-acceptance. Here's how it worked for Len, a young man pursuing a career playing the guitar in rock bands. He sought treatment because he felt like a second-rate musician. From the time he was young, he was convinced he had to be a genius in order to be appreciated. He was easily hurt by criticism and often made himself miserable by comparing himself with better-known musicians. He would feel deflated when he told himself, "I'm a nobody in comparison with X." He was certain that his friends and fans also viewed him as a mediocre person, and he concluded that he could never receive his fair share of the good things in life. Praise, admiration, love, etc. Len utilized the double column technique to expose the nonsense and illogic in what he was saying to himself, which you can see in figure 13.1 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. This helped him to see that it was not a lack of musical talent that was the cause of his problems, but his unrealistic thinking patterns. As he began to correct this distorted thinking, his self-confidence improved. He described the effect of this. Writing down my thoughts and answering them helped me to see how hard I was being on myself, and it gave me a sense that there was something I could do to change. Instead of sitting there getting bombed by what I was telling myself, I suddenly had some anti-aircraft artillery to fight back with. Tune in to what turns you on. One assumption which might be driving you to constant preoccupation with achievement is the idea that true happiness comes only through success in your career. This is unrealistic because the majority of life's satisfactions do not require great achievement at all. It takes no special talent to enjoy an average walk through the woods on an autumn day. You don't have to be outstanding to relish the affectionate hug of your young son. You can enjoy a good game of volleyball tremendously, even though you're just an average player. What are some of life's pleasures that have turned you on? Music? Hiking? Swimming? Food? Travel? Conversation, reading, learning, sports, sex. You don't have to be famous or a top performer to enjoy these to the hilt. Here's how you can turn up the volume so that this kind of music comes in loud and clear. Josh is a 58-year-old man with a history of destructive manic mood swings as well as incapacitating depressions. When he was a child, Josh's parents emphasized over and over that his career was destined to be extraordinary, so he always felt he had to be number one. He eventually did make an exceptional contribution in his chosen field, electrical engineering. He won numerous awards, was appointed to presidential commissions, and was credited with many patents. However, as his cyclic mood disorder became increasingly severe, Josh began to have high episodes. During these periods, his judgment became grossly impaired, and his behavior was so bizarre and disruptive that he had to be hospitalized on several occasions. Sadly, he came down off one high to learn he had lost his family as well as his prestigious career. His wife had filed for divorce, and he had been forced into an early retirement by the company he worked for. 20 years of achievement went down the drain. In the years that followed, Josh was treated with lithium and developed a modest consulting business. Eventually, he was referred to me for treatment because he still experienced uncomfortable mood swings, especially depression, in spite of the lithium. The crux of his depression was clear-cut. He was discouraged about his life because his career no longer measured up in terms of the money and prestige he had experienced in the past. While he had enjoyed the role of charismatic charger as a young man, he was now approaching 60 and felt alone and over the hill. Because he still believed the only way to true happiness and personal worth was through superlative, creative achievements, he felt certain that his constricted career and modest lifestyle made him second rate. Since he was still a good scientist at heart, Josh decided to test his hypothesis that his life was destined to be mediocre by using the pleasure-predicting sheet, described in previous chapters. Each day, he agreed to schedule various activities that might give him a sense of pleasure, satisfaction, or personal growth. These activities could be related to his consulting business, as well as hobbies and recreational pursuits. Before each activity, he was to write down his prediction of how enjoyable it would be and mark it between 0%, no satisfaction at all, and 99%, the maximum enjoyment a human being can experience. After filling out these forms for several days, Josh was surprised to find that life had just as much potential for joy and satisfaction as it ever had. Take a look at the pleasure predicting sheet he filled out in Figure 13.2 on the enhancement. His discovery that work was at times quite rewarding and that numerous other activities could be just as enjoyable, if not more so, was a revelation to him. He was amazed one Saturday night when he went roller skating with his girlfriend. As they moved to the music, Josh found he began to tune into the beat and the melody, and as he became absorbed in the rhythm, he experienced a great sense of exhilaration. The data he collected on the pleasure predicting sheet indicated he didn't need a trip to Stockholm to receive the Nobel Prize to experience the ultimate in satisfaction. He didn't have to go any further than the skating rink. His experiment proved that life was still filled with abundant opportunities for pleasure and fulfillment if he would enlarge his mental focus from a microscopic fixation on work and open himself up to the broad range of rich experiences that living can offer. I am not arguing that success and achievement are undesirable. That would be unrealistic. Being productive and doing well can be enormously satisfying and enjoyable. However, it is neither necessary nor sufficient to be a great achiever in order to be maximally happy. You don't have to earn love or respect on the treadmill, and you don't have to be number one before you can feel fulfilled and know the meaning of inner peace and self-esteem. Now, doesn't that make good sense? Chapter 14. Dare to be average. Ways to overcome perfectionism. I dare you to try to be average. Does the prospect seem blah and boring? Very well. I dare you to try it for just one day. Will you accept the challenge? If you agree, I predict two things will happen. First, you won't be particularly successful at being average. Second, in spite of this, you will receive substantial satisfaction from what you do, more than usual. And if you try to keep this averageness up, I suspect your satisfaction will magnify and turn to joy. That's what this chapter is all about. Learning to defeat perfectionism and enjoy the spoils of pure joy. Think of it this way. There are two doors to enlightenment. One is marked perfection and the other is marked average. The perfection door is ornate, fancy, and seductive. It tempts you. You want very much to go through. The average door seems drab and plain. Ugh, who wants it? So, you try to go through the perfection door and always discover a brick wall on the other side. As you insist on trying to break through, you only end up with a sore nose and a headache. On the other side of the average door, in contrast, there's a magic garden. But it may never